get them up here and get them excited about being here, then maybe we can recruit them to some of those other areas as well to be able to deliver healthcare out there.
A plan to entice more pediatric doctors to rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an early closure for Aygushik fishermen after a tender vessel goes down.
This is the only income most of the people have in the village of Manakodak, and that's how they pay for their fuel and their electricity.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Four pediatric residents got their first taste of Alaskan-style medicine this spring. It's part of a new partnership based at the University of Washington and Seattle Children's Hospital to create an unusual type of medical residency. The doctors will spend one-third of their three-year training in Alaska. The program is designed to help recruit more pediatricians to stay in the state after they graduate, APRN's Annie Feit reports.
As a resident at the University of Washington in Seattle, Dr. Eric Foote is used to biking to work. But when he spent 2 months in Bethel this spring, he decided to try a form of transportation more fitting for the snowy tundra.
I was cross-country skiing to work, and one day it was 20 below, it was really cold, and the snow on my face froze, and I was like, this is cold.
Foote may not have loved the cold in Bethel, but he did love the medicine. He experienced just how remote the rural villages are when he helped medevac a toddler who was having a hard time breathing from a Yukon River community to Bethel. The boy ended up having pneumonia and recovered after an extended stay in the hospital. Foote says cases like that one force pediatricians to work more independently in a place like Bethel.
It's not the same as being in like a big city like Seattle, where the specialists are in the same building and you can call them up and they can come see your patient the same day if you really need them to. So you have to rely more on your clinical judgment and develop more of your skills to deal with the problems as you can and where you are.
Foote is part of the Alaska Track at the University of Washington's pediatric residency. A group of doctors in Anchorage started working to make the idea a reality about 5 years ago as a way to increase the number of pediatricians in the state. Dr. John Tappel was part of those early conversations.
There's the concept that doctors tend to stay where they train. Well, nobody was training in Alaska.
Currently, there's only one residency program in Alaska for family practice doctors. A full pediatric residency was unrealistic in the state because pediatricians in training need exposure to more specialty care patients than a small city like Anchorage can offer. But Tappel says a program that drew University of Washington residents to Alaska for part of their training made a lot of sense.
And we realized that we're one of the few places that could pull it off because we had a major children's hospital down in Seattle. We had a major need up in Alaska, and we had parties willing to work together.
The four residents practice in sites in rural and urban Alaska. By next year, Tappel's clinic, Latouche Pediatrics, will host a rotating group of University of Washington residents throughout the year. Dr. Foote spent 2 months at Latouche after his time in Bethel. On a recent morning, he performed a regular checkup on a slightly reluctant four-year-old.
Can you tip your head up and roar like a lion, go rah! Good.
Foote says he likes being exposed to both rural and urban medicine in Alaska. Dr. Christine Tan, who oversees the program, says it was designed that way. She says there isn't a huge shortage of pediatricians in Anchorage, but rural parts of the state need help recruiting more primary care doctors.
We have seen with the family practice residency that a lot of their graduates go on to do rural medicine across the state, and we're hoping that that will also be true for the pediatric residents. If we can get them up here and get them excited about being here, then maybe we can recruit them to some of those other areas as well to be able to deliver health care out there.
Dr. Foote just finished his first year of residency. He's not ready to make a commitment to stay in Alaska yet, but he says he's definitely considering it. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
After the 78-foot tender Lone Star went down Sunday morning, fishermen at the mouth of the Aygushik River were told to pull their nets. Aygushik fishermen are predominantly from the village of Manicotic. The three-week season provides the sole income for many of them, and the closure came just as the fishing was getting good. KDLG's Dave Benninger reports on the season that almost wasn't.
Whether it was the strong winds or just that time of the run, fishermen in Aygushik say the sockeye had started really hitting their nets over the weekend.
Oh yeah, it was picking up pretty heavily here, and the next thing you know, we're closed.
That's Angela Peacock, a fisherman from Manicotic. She says that on Sunday morning, when she and everyone else in Aygushik heard the distress call over VHF that the Lone Star was taking on water, her first concern was for the safety of the crew. Then when the crew was safe, her thoughts turned to the fuels on board the sinking ship. And later when the call came to pull their nets, she wondered if the season was lost. And for that, answers were not forthcoming.
It was shocking that nobody was here. My husband ended up calling last night wondering, well, where's our basically rescue operation for this, you know, catastrophe?
For a day and a half, it was confusion and frustration. Fish and Game said call the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard said call Fish and Game. A helicopter or two was seen flying over, but no one seemed to have any answers. Then on Monday afternoon, out of the blue, fishing was reopened.
The areas closed in response to the sinking of the tender in the Aygushik River are reopened, effective immediately. Fishermen should still be...
I couldn't believe when I heard that they opened it. Everybody got happy.
That's Ferdinand Sharp, also from Manicotic. Before Aygushik reopened, Sharp says a few fishermen did leave and others were scrambling for any crew jobs still available elsewhere because nobody had had any idea how long the closure would go on, and the clock was ticking.
This is the only income most of the people have in the village of Manicotic, and that's how they pay for their fuel and their electricity and pay for their livelihood up there.
Sarah Catalone, another fisherman from Manicotic, spoke to the confusion as she readied some dinner for her crew Monday night.
We were lost. I mean, we were thinking, are we done fishing? Are we closed for the season? My main concern was for the residents that depend on this income to survive in the winter. I was even thinking, like, if it was a major oil spill, if they would be given assistance for lost income.
Some fuel had been seen leaking from the Lone Star Sunday and Monday, but fishing in Aygushik is open, and after dinner, Sarah, her son Kyle, and crewman Wassily clean their net and make a delivery. Then we detoured past the sunken ship.
It's the first time I've seen a big boat like that upside down. We didn't see a sheen of fuel or diesel. And didn't smell anything, so hopefully everything's contained and we're happy to be fishing again.
Aygushik fishermen are on watch for contaminated fish, and there's concern that winds or tides could create a new fuel leak in the vessel. But for now, most fishermen share an optimistic outlook for the rest of the season.
We still have a run coming, and I'm sure a lot of fish went by, but I think we're still in good shape.
In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Infrared flights have shown that a fire south of Two Rivers is about half the size previously believed because the fire is burning in fingers instead of one solid block. Fire information spokeswoman Mary Huell says the Stewart Creek fire on military land east of Eielson Air Force Base is burning on 30,000 acres, or about 46 square miles. Huell says firefighters were unable to get a flight above the fire until late yesterday. Fire officials are still cautioning residents that an evacuation could be ordered, although cooler temperatures and lighter winds were expected to help firefighters control the blaze. The watch was issued for those living from mile 14 to mile 32 of Chena Hot Springs Road. The Skinnies Road fire, burning between Fairbanks and Enana, is reported to be nearing containment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book about the Mount Marathon race from an elder race participant.
I was 59. He said, well, hey, Millie, why don't we try running that race next year? And so I said, well, okay.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Eric Strabel won the men's division in the annual 4th of July Mount Marathon race in Seward today. The Anchorage Daily News reports Strabel won, setting a new record with an unofficial time of 42 minutes, 55 seconds. Ricky Gates followed him in seconds later, still fast enough to score a record-breaking finish at 43 minutes, 5 seconds. The race was muddy this year, but that didn't stop a rookie from taking the women's title. Palmer resident Christy Marvin clocked in at 53 minutes 20 seconds, winning by nearly 2 minutes. Allison Barnwell, a 21-year-old Seward resident, took second at 55 minutes 11 seconds. This year, the race has undergone a few changes since 65-year-old Anchorage runner Michael Lemaitre was reported missing during the 2012 race. Almost a year later, there has been no trace of Lemaitre. Another Anchorage runner, Matt Kenny, is still recovering from a devastating fall last year. For the 2013 event, runners have to sign a statement saying they've completed the race course before. Senior racers also have to get to the halfway point in less than 60 minutes, or they will be disqualified and sent back down the mountain. Although the top finishers tend to be on the younger side, that doesn't mean there aren't plenty of elders who also take on the 3,022-foot peak on the annual 4th of July run. Millie Speasley is the author of a new book called Mount Marathon, Alaska's Great Foot Race. Speasley moved to Anchorage in 1955 and started watching the Mount Marathon race in the 90s. She says she admired the runners, but realized the race was about more than those who ran up the mountain.
It's really about the small city of Seward and about the 4th of July, really. It was that feeling of celebration, I think, for the 4th of July that really drew me to Seward and the race to see. So, and then I do admire people who are really fit. I mean, I was never as fit as these young runners when I was their age, you know, so it took me a while to work into it.
What was the year that you watched the first Mount Marathon race?
Well, let's see. I started running the race 15 years ago. So that was 97, I believe. So I probably watched the race about 95.
Did you decide right then, I'm going to run that race?
Never entered my mind. It looked too difficult. It looked like something, you know, I was in 95, I was, 58 years old. So, you know, it wasn't in my little realm of possibilities. So anyhow, I had a friend, Charlie Brown, who is about 6 years older. And so when we were there, I was 59, he said, well, hey, Millie, why don't we try running that race next year? And so I said, well, okay. And so it was more of a group little activity that we thought we'd do. And so we trained then, had somebody to train with, and found out when on my first trip up, I found, you know, I was always surprised that I actually could make it up the mountain, you know. this was rather tricky, you know. So then I found it wasn't as difficult as for me, it was possible. Not in a speedy way, because I'm never going to be at the front of the line. I'm always near the end. But that's okay with me. And I always tell people, the day after the race, nobody's going to know or care what my time was. So it takes the pressure off.
Did you talk to other people who had ran the Mount Marathon race, who had started that late in life?
Well, actually, my friend Charlie Brown, he was a runner also, like in street races and all, and he started, I believe, over 60. Corky Cortell, he started when he was over 60. He ran till he was 82, and then he had a medical problem where he'd still be running. His heart is still there. I think there are probably not a lot, but a handful that start older.
Millie, are you running the race this year?
Well, I plan on it, yes. I always tell people running isn't exactly the adjective that they use when I go up the mountain, you know. But it's a climb for me, you know, and it's a challenge. And so I always, we all have different goals. And mine, again, is just to get up and get down and feel good when it's over, you know.
And do you mind my asking how old you are this year?
Well, 75, soon to be 76 in September. But I feel, you know, I feel younger than I did when I was younger, because you accept life for what it is a lot more and enjoy it a lot more, because possibly I don't have the years left, so I'm going to enjoy those that I have, you know. Not that I haven't enjoyed it, but I think we savor it a little more.
Millie Speasley is the author of Mount Marathon, Alaska's Great Foot Race. No word yet on Millie's time in today's race. State Senator Bert Stedman has added his name to the list of Alaskans hoping to repeal the state's new oil tax structure. The Sitka Republican signed a petition on Tuesday against Senate Bill 21. Supporters of the measure, which was signed into law by Governor Sean Parnell, say it will spur more development in Alaska, but opponents like Stedman call it an oil giveaway. KCAW's Ed Ronco was with the senator as he signed his name inside a Sitka cafe.
Like any coffee shop, the Backdoor Cafe is a gathering place where residents talk about current events and local politics over mugs of hot espresso and steamed milk. The walls here are decorated with local art and also with the campaign swag of local politicians, Democrats mostly. So while this place is no stranger to political action, it's something of a novelty to see a Republican state senator standing at the counter receiving a petition from cafe owner Bernadette Rasmussen.
So what they want here is your printed name as it appears on your voter registration card. We need all of this information. You have choices here, your signature.
Stedman and his family sat down at a nearby table with the light blue petition booklet. Stedman signed, so did his wife, Lorene, so did their daughter, Susan.
That's her first official act as a registered voter.
Just outside the cafe, Stedman joked that politics are a family affair and said he wants voters to have a say on the oil tax bill he spent most of the last legislative session opposing.
So I encourage a full public process. And down on the islands in Southeast, we're certainly not afraid of public process. We have lots of it. So I see nothing wrong with having a thorough scrubbing in the media and the Alaskans around the state going to the ballot box a year from August and voicing their opinion.
Changes to Alaska's oil tax structure in Senate Bill 21 could cost about $6 billion over the next 5 years. That's according to a fiscal memo attached to the legislation. And Stedman's opposition to the bill puts him at odds with many in his party. He says the majority of Republicans, especially those inside the rail belt between Anchorage and Fairbanks, favor the new tax structure, but that those opinions are not as unified in the state's rural areas. And Stedman says he himself is not even opposed to redoing Alaska's oil tax structure, which is called Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share, or ACES for short. But he says the debate is not all or nothing either.
So the question isn't take ACES and be happy, or take Senate Bill 21 and, you know, run us off the road. There's a middle ground in here where we could modify the tax structure to keep our basin competitive, yet not give away the farm. And when somebody stands up and says, we have to take 21 and there's no other alternative, don't buy it.
The repeal that Stedman supports, of course, has plenty of opponents. Among them is the Make Alaska Competitive Coalition in Anchorage. The State Chamber of Commerce and chambers in Juneau, Fairbanks, and Kenai have joined the coalition against the repeal, along with a host of other statewide organizations, companies, and individuals. One of those organizations is the Alaska Support Industry Alliance. The Anchorage-based trade association represents the companies that support the state's gas and oil industries. Its members employ about 30,000 people in the state.
We need to increase increase production. That's what SB 21 was designed to do. So that's one part of the equation.
The other part of the equation, says Alliance General Manager Rebecca Logan, is to bring sustainability and stability to Alaska's state budget, which depends on oil revenue.
The thing we've heard repeatedly from everybody in the testimony is that it's very hard for people to invest billions of dollars here when we're constantly changing our tax structure. So we change our tax structure again, and within 4 days of that change, we start a referendum to repeal that. And in my mind, that's the definition of instability, and we are trying to avoid that.
So let's go back to the other side of this argument and the petition that Stedman signed. Organizers estimate they have about 28,000 signatures across the entire state in favor of repeal so far. They need more than 30,000 to put the issue before voters in August of 2014. Stedman says if the petition is successful, it'll be an uphill battle for those hoping to overturn Senate Bill 21.
And it's going to be the David versus the Goliath discussion. But, you know, when people sit and think about it a minute, they own that oil. And the tax is nothing more than the price to sell it.
In Sitka, organizers estimate they've gathered about 800 signatures so far and estimate they'll break 1,000 when all is said and done. They're planning a final push to gather those signatures at Sitka's 4th of July festivities before mailing the books to Anchorage on the 5th. The overall deadline for the petitions is July 13th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
State education officials are in Atlanta for a national assembly. National Education Association Alaska President Ron Furr says in light of recent school shooting tragedies, there is a heightened concern over school safety. But he says that doesn't mean teachers should be armed.
The last thing that an educator should be concerned about is trying to shoot someone. They should be there looking after the students, providing them a safe exit, and not concerned about confronting someone in the school building.
Furr says educators believe that schools are generally safe and safety drills are performed regularly. Furr says current immigration policy has a harmful impact on students. He says reform that creates a path to citizenship needs to happen. He says adequate school funding in Alaska has been challenging and troubling. He says there has not been an increase in the base student allocation in Alaska in 4 years, and schools across the state are cutting their budgets every year.
While at the very same time, our state has one of, if not the highest, surpluses in resources for the last 4 years. Granted, oil prices were high, but we were nearing $20 billion in savings over the last, 4 years, where we've had no net increase. So it seems to be, I'm still trying to get my head around that scenario where we're one of the richest states, but yet we don't increase the funding for our future, which is our students.
Furr says the controversy over funding private schools must be clarified. He says there is a big difference between charter schools that operate within the public school system and private schools that are religious or for-profit entities. He says Alaska has one of the best charter school laws in the country, and charter immersion programs operating within the school districts in Alaska do well and don't increase administrative costs because they operate within the districts.
These charter schools, there could be more of them that are more tailor-made to certain constituencies. Unfortunately, we're not getting the funding. But then some legislators want to, quote-unquote, use the public funding for these private, religious, or for-profit charter schools. If this were to be done, they would be outside the public school system, and they'd have to create their own administration, increasing costs, not decreasing costs.
Two pieces of legislation dealing with using public dollars for private schools were brought forward in the last legislative session. One would have amended the state constitution to allow state money to flow to private schools. Another bill would have allowed private schools to be formed outside public school districts. Currently, only public school districts can develop charter schools in Alaska. Neither bill made it to the floor for a vote, but both pieces of legislation could come up again next year. The United States Geological Survey has been conducting research on the amounts of sea ice present in the Chukchi Sea, and they've identified that the lifestyles of walruses are changing. KNOM's Margaret DeMaiorius reports.
Chad Jay is the project lead for the U.S. Geological Survey Walrus Research Program. He says the loss of sea ice significantly affects the day-to-day activities of walruses.
Sea ice is important to walruses not only in how it affects the ecosystem and the amount of food that falls to the bottom and ultimately is, you know, clam meat for walruses, but also it serves as a platform, and that physical platform is very important as well.
The sea ice platform allows for rest time for walruses between foraging for food and serves as a location for mothers to give birth and to nurse their young. However, now that sea ice is disappearing, Jay says walruses are hauling out of the water onto beaches in groups of thousands. And that's causing an increased mortality to females and young because they're getting trampled. The USGS has been studying large groups of walruses at Point Lay that have hauled out on coastal beaches, specifically looking at their feeding behaviors. Initially, Jay says the groups were feeding close to coastal areas, but recent data shows that is changing.
You know, we're speculating, but we think they may be exhausting their food supply near these nearshore areas here, and now are forced to start swimming up to some of the areas that they were feeding in the past that are well offshore.
Jay estimates well offshore to be about 80 to 90 miles away from the coastline. Jay comments that many young calves that are making those long trips with their mothers will most likely not survive. But sea ice is not the only issue impacting walruses. Jay says the animals are also affected by increased human activities in the Arctic.
You see more ship traffic and more oil and gas activities up in the north. And of course, we just expect that to increase with time.
In about 2 weeks, another ship is headed back out into the Chukchi Sea to do more tracking and data collection.
That report from KNOM's Margaret DeMaiorius. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Margaret DeMaiorius in Nome. APRN's Annie Fite reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.